Okay, so now it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker today, Daniel W. from California.
My name is Daniel W. I'm a recovering addict. And as always, I want to thank God for being clean, and I want to thank God for being clean in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. And I want to thank the WCNA 34 for allowing me to participate in my recovery in the spirit of unity. And, you know, I needed to say that I thought a lot about what I was going to say when I came up here, and I thought the best solution would be just to be my authentic self. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you a little bit about who I am, and I know this is a topic discussion. And I believe the topic is applying the lessons of parenting. But before I do that, I want to give a shout out to what I believe, and it's my opinion only, the greatest area in the world, the greater Los Angeles area with Narcotics Anonymous. And I want to thank them for supporting me. I want to thank them for supporting me as I've been blessed with this platform and this opportunity to carry what I hope is a clear-cut message of Narcotics Anonymous. And, you know, I thought about, you know, this topic, applying the lessons of parenting, Sean. And at first I didn't know if it was a joke. But I kind of come to understand that God works in mysterious ways. And I could think of a plethora of people that could have came up here and talked about the lessons of parenting. Ladies and gentlemen that I know that have raised their children on their own, that I have seen do a remarkable job, that I've had the opportunity to witness their children come into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, and they trudge with them. And they raised them well, and they've done a good job all by themselves. So I would only imagine that this was God's choice for me to come up here and to share this message today. And so I'll do the best that I can. You know, I was, I'm the fourth child of four children, you know. And my father was a practicing alcoholic. And I think that had a lot to do with the passion and the love and concern that I have for my children. Now, I'm not saying that I'm the best father in the world. I'm not saying that I've set the best examples. But what I am saying is that I'm not a daddy. I am my children's father. And I'm honored that their lives are a priority to me. And it matters to me what they become. And so I make sacrifices in regards to that. You know, I didn't show up to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, World Convention of Narcotics Anonymous number 34 on Thursday, not because I'm impecunious, nor am I working with a great deal of opulence, but I showed up on Friday morning because I had some responsibilities that I had to take care of in Los Angeles in regards to doing something that might contribute to helping my family. And that's what you people have taught me in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. You have taught me that love has to be my dominant life value. You know, love is one of the spiritual principles in our literature. You know, I've had to learn that since I'm not dealing with a little bit of money, I'm not totally broke, but I'm not dealing with a great deal of money, that love is going to have to be my dominant life value, because that's the most precious gift that I can give my family. See, because love means that I'm giving them time. You know, and I have to learn that via the steps and the traditions of Narcotics Anonymous. See, for a lot of years, Daniel came into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, and my thing was, if I got the money, you got the kids. But I've evolved and I've learned that's my responsibility to co-parent, to be that father, to not lack those things that my father lacked because of his disease. That's what I don't want to do. So I show up at the PTA meetings, and I show up at the open house meetings, and I show up at the parents' conference meetings, and I show up at the track meets and the football games, and I know the teachers by name, and they know my email address, and I know their email addresses. Because that's what you people have taught me. And I'm grateful. You know, I'm grateful, man. You know, in our literature, it talks about love in the harvest. Love in the harvest, and it comes in the right season. The season has come. You know, the season has come. You know, although I have lacked in areas of my life, right? You know, I can't really lie about anything because, see, the greater Los Angeles area is in here, right? You know, see, and like, you know, my life has kind of like been like on Channel 7, Channel 11. So it's nothing that I could possibly come out of here at this world convention and lie about. You know, I didn't rehearse anything. I didn't write nothing down. You know, it's always been the language of the heart. And that's what has kept me clean for 21 years plus months. And I could call out a lot of names, you know, and, you know, people that have helped me, but I might leave somebody out, and I don't want to do that, you know. But love, you know, now I'm going to tell you something. Why I say love, and I'm going to talk about that love a little while, right, because what I say is love has to be my dominant life value. Because, see, I have 3 children by my wife, right? I got a plethora of kids, right? I mean, you know, I got 5. You know, I got 5 children. I have 4 beautiful daughters, and I have a son. And one of the things that I had to do, ladies and gentlemen, one of the things that I had to do in my recovery is I had to go to my God of my understanding, I had to ask him to forgive me. Forgive me for the abortions that the women had for me. Forgive me for planting my seed in a whole lot of places and not being willing to step up in a responsible man and support those children. I had to ask God to forgive me that in my work. Forgive me for not being man enough to step up and tell that woman to keep my child. I'm talking about that because that was a very painful situation for me. And the jarring experience for me was when I went to this clinic with this sister and I seen her abort this child and I swore I would never go back again. See, I had never been to the clinic. I just sent y'all. But when I went, it's something I'll never forget. And I swore that I would never participate in that again. You know, my oldest daughter is 27, and she blessed me with a son. She named him after me. His name is Daniel. And I remember, you know, at that time when my girlfriend was pregnant with her, and her water bag busted at Scissors on Figueroa right in the USC area. And I remember taking her to the hospital. And I remember leaving and saying, I'll be back. And I'm going to never show back up. Because I was young and I was a coward and I really didn't understand the importance of being there and being supportive and saying, breathe. And you know how we do when you're having a baby, right? I didn't understand the importance of that, right? And so I had to live that down for a lot of years. And I told God that, you know, I will be there to see all the rest of my children born. And I did pretty good with 3 of them. And I'm going to tell you why I didn't get a chance to experience that 4th one, because I told you I had 5. So you know I missed the first one, and I missed another one for no heir of my own. You know, but I made a conscious decision that I was going to be there to witness my children born, no matter what the circumstances were. And I did that. I did that. Now, just so you know, on this world level, that I'm going to say this because I know this is going to help somebody, and I know somebody's going to be able to identify with this, you know. I've been married 19 years on August the 29th of last year. Don't clap yet. I got a 27-year-old daughter by my wife. I got a 14-year-old daughter by my wife. I got a 10-year-old daughter by my wife. And I got a 9-year-old daughter by a sister on this program. And I've been married 19 years. And I got a 19-year-old son by another young lady. And that happened before I got married. Just a little bit before I got married. Now, I said that to say that somebody can identify with that one. But it may be something that you may not be able to identify with. And I'm going to say this to you because this might help you. One of the things that I've learned around here, and when I talk about that dominant life value called love, is that, see, a dominant life value called love will make you be there for your children no matter what. And I don't say this to talk about nobody, because I heard my boy Eldridge talking about integrity, and I understand that word. And I know it's not for me to get up here and talk about nobody. But what I'm saying is that a dominant life value will make you show up for your children. See, a dominant life value will make you go into the judicial system if you need to. A dominant life value will make you say, if I got to pay child support, I will. See, a dominant life value called love will make you show up no matter what. And it talks about that in our literature. It talks about we may not be able to rekindle those emotional relationships, but we still have a responsibility to those children. And yeah, you're going to get angry sometime when they get your money. Absolutely. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be frustrating. You know, see, a dominant life value will make you go back and say, you know what, when this boy was 3 years old, I went and asked him, is this my son? And they told me no. And I said, let's get a DNA. And she told me, no, this is not yours. And then you run into him 12 years later and they say, look, this is your son. And I said, well, I asked you about that when he was 3. And you said, I know. The dominant life value called love will make you take that DNA when he's 15 and find out that it's 99.9% yours. And what that dominant life value will make you do is it will make you embrace that son, the son you've always wanted your whole life. He'll make you embrace that son and jump into his life like you've been there his whole life. That's what that dominant life value will do, because that's what I did. And those were some people that told me, man, I don't know. See, I'm talking about love. You know, and I always talk about this, you know, I'm being my authentic self, but I like movies, right? Y'all like movies, right? I need to tell y'all I'm a crybaby. I'm a crybaby, right? But sometimes I watch movies that I can really identify with, right? And I share this, right? Because, see, my love, not only for my children, for people that I become attached with, it gets so strong and it gets so emotional, Derek, that I just reach out and I just want to just be all I can to them. No matter how antagonistic they are toward me sometimes. Sometimes I just keep being that sucker and just keep going back. You understand what I'm saying? That's me. And I'm too. I'm like James Garner, right? See, in the notebook, he had a real big love for this girl named Allie. Right? Right? Man, he loved Allie. He loved Allie so much that he took his last breath with Allie. You know, but what he said at the beginning of the movie, he said that, you know what? And this is Daniel. Because I told you I'm not impecunious, neither I'm working with a great deal of opulence. So my love is my dominant life value. That's my riches, right? But he said, I'm a common man. And I've lived a simple life. And when I die, my name will soon be forgotten. There are no special monuments or no rewards that are in my name. He said, but in one respect, I have lived a glorious life as any. You know why? He said, because I have loved another with all my heart. And for me, that has been enough. That's what he said. And when he said that, church, I made a tear roll out of my eye.
because I felt that. And I felt that love. And I need to tell you, I watch movies and I cry because I'm an emotional person. I went and watched The Help and I cried. You know, I watched these movies and I cried. My wife was like, "You crying?"
You know, but don't be confused about it. I understand why I'm here. See, I'm here, you know, yeah, I could talk about love and I could talk about parenting, but believe me, this is a therapeutic value, one addict helping another. And in the midst of everything I go to, right, I stay clean. See, being clean has to be a priority. Because if you're not clean, you're not going to be able to show up for nothing else. See, because our literature says it, right? It says based on our experience, we believe that every addict, including a potential addict, suffers from an incurable disease of the body, the mind, and the spirit. We're in the grip of a hopeless dilemma, the solution of which is spiritual in nature. Therefore, this book deals with spiritual matters. Then it says we are not a religious program. Our program is a set of spiritual principles through which we are recovering from a seamless, hopeless state of mind and body. And it's a plan to go with it, right? It says, throughout the compiling of our work, we have prayed. God, grant us knowledge that we might write according to our divine precepts. And instill in us a sense of your purpose and make a service of your will. Grant us a bond of selflessness that we might carry out your work, not ours. In order that not out of anywhere, what? We die from the horrors of addiction. So I know, you know what, my story is my story, but you know what, recovery is in the literature. And your view of the world will change, just like it says in the literature, it says in the literature, it says as we become more central in recovery, and we internalize the spiritual principles embodied in the step, guess what, our view of the world will change profoundly. You know, you'll start understanding why I need to be here instead of at a meeting. You understand why I couldn't come on a Thursday and I had to come on a Friday because I had to do something that was going to be beneficial to my family. You understand why I can't come to a meeting every night because I got things that I need to do for my kids. You understand why I make my kids' school clothes a priority over my school clothes. You'll understand that as your life becomes more central in recovery because you'll be working with that principle called selflessness, not selfishness. Because selfishness will make me show up here with a pocket full of money, right, putting on my Sunday best. Don't know where my kids are. I know I hit somebody with that one. Don't know where my kids are. You know, I don't think I'm trying to stand up here and say that, you know what, I'm the bomb, I'm that super dad, and I'm looking for the hero award of the year. I could have not done any of this without it been for my wife. Because she ain't on this program, but believe me, I know women do recover. Women do recover. Because there's some powerful women in these rooms. Powerful mothers in these rooms. Powerful daughters. Powerful nieces that I have seen come in here. I was talking to a sister at the jazz breakfast. She was talking about her mother as a priority. I heard you, Carla. She said, my mother is a priority. She talked about being in a disease and being grateful for being able to give back, and so am I. See, I'm so grateful for Granny Williams, Dorothy Williams today. We call her Granny Williams. You know, I'm grateful for the 81 years of life since she's been on this earth. And for what she instilled in me and the principles and the values that not only her, but even my father and his disease instilled in me. You see, I have three siblings, right? And even though my father was a practicing alcoholic all of his life, all of us wind up with some good work ethics. I got two brothers and I got a sister, and we all have been working our whole lives. All of us take care of our children. So this is something that I saw as a young child. I remember running down to the bus stop because my mother did piece work in Hollywood, and she did a lot of apartment cleaning and a lot of house cleaning for a lot of prominent actors. I've been all up in J.J., Good Times, and all that house here. I went up in Bobby Sherman's house. I went up in all of their houses. And you know what? The thing would happen with me when I went in their houses, and it's only by the grace of God that my mother kept them contracts, because my disease was even, it was active young before I even picked up. Before I even picked up, my disease was in motion, right? Because I always went in their house and came out weighing a little bit more than I did when I went in. And I had to make an amends to my dear mother. And I told her, you know what? She said, boy, you could have made me lose my job. And I'm like, I know, Mama. I know. And forgive me. But I've been there for her, you know. And I brought her up because you need to know that I got to the rooms in Narcotics Anonymous on the prayers of Dorothy Williams. I got to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous via my mother and God. God and my mother. Let me put it in the correct order. And then when I got here, you guys embraced me. You took me in. You nurtured me. You know, and it's been history. It hasn't been a good history, all of it, but I'm here. I'm being responsible as I can possibly be, you know. And for me, that's all I can ask for. You know, see, I came around here like a lot of people. Man, I came around here D42956. Oh, some of y'all don't know what that means, huh? That's not who I am anymore. I'm a product of society. I'm a taxpayer. I'm a homeowner. I'm a husband. I'm a father. I have a job. I'm gainfully employed. I'm in school. I got 3 more classes before I transfer to a university. And at 49 years old, I still know it's about my mind, my body, and my spirit. I still know, Charles, it's about my attitude, my behavior, and my conversation. I still know that although we are autonomous, as the Fourth Tradition says, it's my responsibility to conduct myself in a manner of a way when I'm out in public. And it's only by the grace of God and Big Lee. I have some friends around here that have saved me from me. That have saved me from me. Because I have not always conducted myself in a mannerable way. I had to learn some behaviors around here. I've learned today that anger, this says this in the literature, right? It says anger is the reaction of my present reality. I'm not angry today. So I don't have to lash back at you when you lash at me. I don't have to do that today. I got 5 children by 3 different women. I don't call none of them out their name today. For me, that's a blessing. Because I got a mouth like a sailor. So for me to respect you as a mother of my children is a lot for me. That's a lot for me. For me to show up and be responsible for my family, it's a lot for me. You know, last night, man, I was thinking about what I was going to say. I was thinking about this platform, and I was thinking about a book that I had wrote, you know, I mean, not wrote. I ain't wrote one yet. Book that I had read, you know, because I like to read books, but I like to read books that are going to help me, you know. And I read this book by this guy, you know, a lot of you guys don't know him. His name is Tony Dungy. And the book was called A Mentor Leader. And he talked a lot about platforms. He talked a lot about making the best of the platforms that you have. You know, and the platform that I have every day, man, I try to make the best of it, you know. I feel so much love today, man. You know, that's why I talked about the dominant life value. I feel a lot of love in these rooms. You know, my life would be my life would be nowhere near where it is today had it not been for these rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I watched that film last night, man, and at Bob B's 50th party, and I was honored to know him, honored to say that I've been eating dinner with him personally for multiple years, honored to see my photo on the slide, honored to know that you people have been a part of my life. See, when I got here, D, man, I didn't want to be no addict. Now watch this here. Wait a minute. Hold on. Let me back up. I still don't want to be one. Man, don't get it twisted. Look, don't get it twisted. I'm proud of the fact that I know what I am, but I'm not honored to be one. You know, I still don't want to be at it. But I'm grateful to know that I'm one. You know, and I understand. Is this for me? Thank you, man. You know I got to drive my phone. I'm grateful to know this. You know, and our literature talks about the nature of an addict will never change. But the old lie that once an addict, always an addict, can change as we work this program of recovery. And that's why I identify myself as a recovering addict. Now, if the nature of an addict never changes, then I doggone sure want to be a recovering addict. Right? You know what I'm saying, Moso? I want to be a recovering addict. You know? Because that's what my life exhibits. My life exhibits the behavior of a recovering addict. Now, I didn't say that I don't have no defects of character, Jazz. I didn't say that I don't act out on them in no shortcomings, Mike. That's not what I said. I said that my life exhibits the behavior of a recovering addict. My job allows me to go in and out of people's residence with a little bit of authority. There is no way possible that I would have been able to do that had it not been for the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, the 12 traditions and the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. If you knew me like the people in Grand Los Angeles area knew me, you would understand what I mean. Because I'm the one that came to the meeting with the dope in the trunk, with the lowrider parked in front of the meeting, and was going back to Crenshaw with the dope in my trunk after the meeting. And it ain't like that today. It ain't like that today, and it ain't been like that over 18 years. It has not been like that over 18 years. And I owe that to the God of my understanding. I owe that to these traditions and my friends. You know, I got to say this right here. You know, there was a transition that happened in my life. I don't know how much time, I think I had about 10 years? Oh, something like that. But what happened was, man, is these four guys embraced me, right? Well, it was probably a few more of them, right? But they embraced me, man, and what they did was, man, they started allowing me to come and hang out with them and have dinners. You know, and I think that's when I started eating with Bob, right? And these jokers had me doing some real ridiculous stuff, right? They had me running these marathons. You know what a marathon is? I ain't talking about a marathon meeting. I'm talking about 26.2 miles. But what happened was I started going some places and I started hanging out with these guys that had more time than me. And a funny thing happened. I started slipping further and further away from the hood. Right? And I started getting deeper and deeper into the rooms. And before I knew it, I was all the way in the rooms. Now, you know, we got gangs in L.A., right? So, let me tell you what happened, Rourke. It kind of gave me a black eye, right? Because I told you I came around here low-riding, and, you know, they was talking about putting plaques in the back of the low-riders for this low-rider club, and, you know, and I was hanging with these guys, and my life was transitioning, right? So what happened was I started, you know, they had this plaque that they wanted me to put in the back of my lowrider, right? Now, you know, I grew up as, you know, blood, right? So they had this plaque they wanted me to put in the back of my car. It was called Damu Riders. That's blood in Swahili, if y'all don't know what that means, right? They wanted me to put this in the back of my car, right? And I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that. I couldn't do it, not because I was scared. I couldn't do it because I felt like, how can I represent Narcotics Anonymous and have this in the back of my car? That's my truth. It's the same way I felt when I was at this first recovery house. Her name is Cheryl B. She don't mind me breaking her anonymity. They opened up a recovery house in my neighborhood, a house that I used to get high at, right? And they made it a recovery center, right? A recovery house, clean living facility, right? And they was announcing they wanted to get trusted service. And they asked me to be a secretary. And I had 9 ounces in my trunk. And my head was like, I can't be the secretary. You know, so my friend said, he said, well, man, look, just flush the dope. Right? That was some profound shit. The only problem was with it, cha-cha-cha. I wasn't finna flush no 9 ounces of cocaine. So what I did was I distributed it. But what happened was I never recopped. I never recopped. So I didn't sell any dope no more. The Crips was talking about killing me in the lowrider, so I sold that. They were sending messages, you know, we're going to get him in the green car, so I sold that. And I started running on these marathons with my friends, and I started having dinner with them. And I've been doing it ever since. I've been doing it ever since. You know. I know my time is coming to an end, but the highlight of my day is getting up, going to work every day. Before I go to work, let me just tell you what my agenda is. I'm in the gym at 5:15 in the morning. I work out for about an hour. I go to my job. I do what I'm supposed to do. Get off my job. You know, before I do that, I always ask my wife, is there anything she need me to do? She need me to pick up the kids. What do you need me to do? That's something I used to didn't do. What do you need me to do? You know, my son, you know, is an intricate part of my life. You know, he runs track for college. We have a wonderful relationship. It's ongoing. There's been some trials in that area, you know, but he's a part of my life and he's not by my wife. My daughter, you know, I got joint custody to her. She spends about 15 to 16 days out of the month with me, you know, and I'm still in prayer about that situation. And that's going to be all right for everybody. What I'm saying is they're all a part of my life. They are all a part of my life, and they love me. And I feel the unconditional love, and they love their moms, too. And that's the beautiful thing. The beautiful thing is that we can be there for our children, because I know that's our top. We can be there for our children no matter what. Applying the lessons of parenting. Applying the lessons of parenting. I've learned a lot of lessons. I've learned a lot of lessons. I've seen a lot of things. You know, I almost didn't make it, but I'm here. What I've learned is, in closing, you got to make love your dominant life value. You have to. Men, you got to be there for your children. Women, you got to be there for your children. No matter what. It's not easy. It is not easy. But when I look at them, and they look at me, I know I'm their protector. And I refuse to not allow them to have it. I want to thank you again for allowing me to share and being a part of this wonderful spirit of unity. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. All right. I would like to now introduce our second speaker, Sean R. from Finland.
I'm Sean. I'm a recovering addict. And for all of you guys from L.A. that are leaving, I actually did live in L.A., so you don't have to leave. So I've been a foreigner about half of my life. I can't see if I don't have my glasses on. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank N.A. for allowing me to come up here and speak tonight, this afternoon. When I first got the email saying that I was going to speak on parenting, I thought, what are they thinking? Okay. I am a parent. I'm not a married one. And for me, being a parent was always that you're married. Mom, dad, and kids. I was married 20 years, but it wasn't fun. Anyway, I decided, okay, maybe I'm not married, but I have my experience, strength, and hope, and mistakes, which aren't really mistakes. I learned something. I learned in these rooms that mistakes aren't a bad thing, that I get to learn from my mistakes. If I choose, I have a path in life. You have a path in life. My children have a path in life. I got the parents I did because I needed to learn the lessons that they were going to teach me. You know, I always blamed my parents. Poor me, poor me. Why did I end up with these parents? But what I learned from my parents was how to be independent. I learned from my parents that I would love my children no matter what. I learned from my parents to be responsible, to take care of myself, and to take care of my children. My mom ran off with a preacher when I was about 13. My father wasn't around a lot. He was an A-type. I kind of got that from him. And he was always working. My dad sat all six of us down after my mom left and said, "Shawnee, take over." I was 13. I was number two. My older brother was irresponsible. it's true, but it's a joke. It's a joke in the family. He couldn't do anything in the family. He was brilliant, but completely irresponsible. My mom told me when I was young. Well, I was okay. Here's my self-image at that age. I was in ballet. My mother said I was about as graceful as an elephant. She caught me looking in a mirror once, and she said, "You know, you're already homely. Every time you look in that mirror, you're going to get uglier." It's okay. It's okay. She had her own issues, and I'm okay with it. The image I have of my mother is sitting up in a room with a book, a bottle of Cutty Sark, and a carton of cigarettes. That was my mom. So when she left when I was 13, we were relieved. We got to do drugs in the house, drink whatever we wanted, and live on cookies. We did. We didn't feel really great, so we had to change our diet a little bit. But, yeah, that's what we did. Anyway, there were six of us, and we kind of raised ourselves. And eventually I went off to school, and because I knew that if I didn't go to school and get a job and do something with my life, that I was going to end up like my mom. Unhappy, and she already told me I was stupid, so I was an overachiever. I had to go to university to prove her wrong. So I did. I went to school. I got my master's degree in architecture and structural engineering, And in German. I went to the University of Stuttgart. But there's a lot of beer there. There's a lot of stuff there. It wasn't good for me. But and I kind of hit bottom when I was there. But my girlfriend, her mom was kind of my mom after my mom left, and she was also one of those spiritual astrology, you know, those guys, yeah, the alternatives, which I've kind of turned into over the years. But anyway, she told me, Sean, you're going to want to quit school right before you finish. And she said, don't you dare quit school. She said, you stay in school. No matter what, if it kills you, you stay in school. So about one semester short of graduating, I wanted to quit school. But I kept hearing her voice, don't you dare quit school. So I stayed. I graduated. I came home I was a mess. Anxiety attacks. If I didn't have something in me, alcohol, pot, something, I couldn't function. So I got a job, and after about 6 months, I went to my father and I said, Dad, there's something seriously wrong with me. I don't know what to do. And he said, well, I don't either, so go to a professional. So I went to a psychiatrist, my rent-a-friend. And so for $80 an hour, she listened to me. I didn't have too many friends. I didn't speak. And here's another momism. I'm sorry, Mom. But I heard the quote the other day from one of the old-timers. Better not to say anything and people think you're a fool, or open your mouth and remove all doubt. Yeah. It was one of my mother's favorites. Went along with that, you're stupid. So, yeah, he's my brother, he knows. I didn't talk. I didn't talk at all. I didn't talk to people. I had this face 24/7 that said, don't look at me. Don't talk to me. Don't see me. I was arrogant and I was mean. I was arrogant because I was afraid. I was so afraid of everything. All my childhood, I was afraid. I was afraid of you. I was afraid of me. I was afraid of my parents. I was afraid of what was going to happen. I lived in constant fear. And that was one of the only things when I was new. And if you're new here, it was one of the only things I could relate to. I've never seen heroin in my life. And they have all these cool new drugs. Never seen them. Never seen them. But what I did relate to was the fear. But I have to tell you about what happened when I came into my first meeting. Anyway, I was mean and I was arrogant. I was mean because I kept you away from me. I was arrogant because I didn't know who I was, and it was also a way to keep you away from me. So after the rent-a-friend, and that was interesting chemistry. I had so many pills. I was living on 16 tranquilizers a day, plus assorted sundry items. I had the antidepressants, anti this, anti that, pro this. I had so many drugs. I was a living chemistry set who still couldn't talk. And added bonus, now I couldn't walk out of my house because I couldn't be around people. I would have my pockets full of tranquilizers. So if I had to actually talk to somebody, I learned how to do it without water so that I could just get them down. Finally, I said, you know what? I don't want to live like this. I was barely awake most of the time. I was kind of in this haze of almost asleep. And so I said, you know, this isn't right. The anxiety attacks are still there. I still have them. So the drugs aren't really helping that. But now I feel even worse because I don't feel like I'm living. And so I went to a clinic. And I said, what's wrong with me? It was a drug and alcohol clinic in Chicago. And I said, what's wrong with me? And they said, well, you're a drug addict alcoholic. And I said, oh, thank God, now I know what's wrong with me. So I went in for a 28-day treatment, but I didn't last for, I only lasted 3 days because my stepmother, she came to get me. She came with my father, and she said she just wants attention. And I said, okay, I'll leave. And they told me at the recovery house, they said, just go to meetings every day. Okay, there were no NA meetings where I was living at the time. So I went to AA in the beginning. And okay, I have to tell you about my first meeting because it still amuses me. I walk into this meeting in Lansing, Illinois, and they laugh too much. The women had big hair. And God help me, powder blue polyester pantsuits. They were old. They offended my sense of style. And they used bad grammar. Hello. I was like, seriously, I have to do this with these people? Then at the end of the meeting, this old guy walks up to me and he says, darling, you ain't got no self-esteem. And, you know, I had that moment of terror because here I was. I had a master's degree, and I didn't know what self-esteem was. I had no idea what self-esteem was because I didn't have any. And I didn't know how to get it. And I had to stay in these rooms to figure it out. You taught me what self-esteem was. It's not something you can get, you know, not on eBay, not anywhere. I had to work to acquire it. I had to be of service. I had to be loving. I had to be open. I had to be willing. I had to be those things that you said. I had to be humble. I didn't know anything about those. And those were the lessons that I had to learn. I had to learn who I was. One of the things that I asked my psychiatrist before I got clean, I said, am I nice or am I mean? I didn't know. And even worse, I didn't know I had a choice. I didn't know I could choose to be kind. I didn't know. I thought you were just you were who you were, but I didn't know who I was. But I figured you got your deck of cards and that was it. I didn't know I had a choice. I didn't know that I was responsible for my life. I am responsible for my life. So anyway, they said don't make any major changes. So I moved to LA at 60 days. Then they said, don't make any more, you know, major changes. So I got married. And they said, really seriously, don't make any more major changes. So I moved to Finland. So I don't always follow directions. But what I did do right was I always went to meetings. Always. I always went to meetings. My first NA meeting was in L.A., or actually it was down by San Diego. It was on this old beach house. I don't know. You guys probably know it. I don't know where it is anymore. But it was in a house right on the beach. It was this old thing, and there are a bunch of old surfer hippie dudes. And I was not a hippie. I was never cool. Seriously, I was never cool. I know you find that hard to believe, but I was way never cool. No, didn't happen. I accidentally got picked as a cheerleader once. That was as close to cool as I ever got. And that was only because I was good in gymnastics. So, yeah, but otherwise, I stood up there like a doodlehead, like, what are they playing? Okay, football, go. I didn't get it. I didn't get it. Not cool. And because I was taking care of my siblings when I was a teenager, when everybody was at the disco, they learned all those sexy moves. I can't dance. Never learned them. Never learned how to dance. But never learned how to sing either. But I was talking to somebody this morning, and my kids, I have four, 23, 20, 18, and 14, two boys, two girls. They have never seen me drunk or using. They've never seen me high. I have to say something about my children because they are my life. I'm a single mom. I'm not married. I was married 20 years, and it was rough. The divorce was rougher. But he was also in the program. Another thing, if you're new, seriously, don't get married. And, you know, I mean, not no, you can get married. No, I think marriage is great, but not when you're only a year clean. I had no idea who he was. I didn't know who he was. But I didn't believe in divorce. Absolutely did not believe in divorce. I thought once you got married, you stayed married. And I did everything. I had more kids. I did everything I could think of to make the marriage work. It didn't. And eventually, it was killing me. I had ulcers. I was a nervous wreck. It was killing me. And it wasn't good for my children. And I had a few broken bones, too. But at one point, I said, you know, I asked God, I said, really, I'm a little bit dense, so send me some bricks. Tell me what to do. He sent lots. Finally, and I didn't get it. Finally, my head hit the marble floor, and I got a concussion. I said, okay. I get it. That was the brick. Okay. So. Then I had to learn how to be a parent by myself. And I was terrified. I don't have mental, financial, spiritual, any kind of support from him. So I was on my own with four children. And it scared me. And I had to go back and make a decision. What kind of a parent am I going to be? I've got sole responsibility for these little dumplings. So what am I going to do? And you talked about love. Unconditional love. My children grew up knowing and hearing from me, I love you no matter what. I may not always love your behavior, but I love you no matter what. And I had to be their safe place, that they knew that they could always come home. I was their safe place. No matter what happened, I would be there, and I would support them. There may be some consequences at times, but I was there. I was their safe place. So you can come home. You can talk to me about anything. But talk to me. Talk. Otherwise, I don't know what's going on with you. So a little bit about my four children and what happened with us. We're still in Finland, obviously. And I've got two in university now, one in a high school in Czech Republic and one that's still in, he's in ninth grade now, my youngest, George. George was named after my father. George knows everything about my recovery. Well, they all do, but the older ones have kind of gone away. But George is at home always with me. And I have to tell you about the phone call. I don't want to forget the phone call I made today. George says, you know, Mom, you don't dance. And I said, yeah, I can't dance. He said, okay, well, we're going to have our own dance then. So my little boy years ago, he held on to me so that because I didn't want to be without hands. And so we have our own little happy dance. And he says, okay, Mom, we're going to dance now. So he's such a loving child. When I called him this morning, I said, George, tell me something. What do you think of me as a parent? I got to talk about being a parent today. What do you think about it? And he said, Mom, I always knew you loved me. We have a thing with my kids. We don't ever sign our emails or our text messages love, you know, like love Mom. It's always LYWW, love you whole world. They always sign it LYWW. The other thing is I always told him that Mama's always come back. Maybe because of my own mom, I don't know what the reason was, but when they were afraid that I wouldn't come back, I always told him, Mama's always come back. Don't worry. I'll always be here for you. When my son, he went around the world with about $2.99 in his pocket. And yeah, you'd have to know Frank. He's a vegan hippie type, but never touched a drug, never touched a glass of alcohol. He's 23, and he's at the university. But anyway, he went on a world trip, and I said, I'm scared to death, but I'll let you go. But just call me every Monday, please. Wherever you are, call me every Monday, and then I know you're all right. And he called me every Monday for a year without fail, and I was so grateful for that. But when I opened my computer the day that he left, I don't know if I'll be able to get through this, I opened up my computer. There's a sticky note on my computer, and it said, Sons always come back too. He did. He came back. But I'll talk about another child of mine that has learned something from the program. My daughter Delia. She's studying in the Czech Republic. She's in high school there. And my children learned words like gratitude. They learned words like responsibility. They learned humility. They learned all of these things that I learned in the program because I would come home and talk to them about it. My children decided that they were going to do a little service project, and I was grateful for that because I said, you know, let's do something to be of service. They decided that they would go to an old folks home and talk to them. And I always loved elderly people. I loved my grandparents. I loved to sit and listen to stories. I worked in a hospital once, and I got to sit and talk to the old people. It was wonderful. Anyway, we went to this old folks home, and my daughter Delia had written out these questions that she wanted to ask these elderly women. This is in Finland. And she sat down with this elderly woman and she said, what was it like when you were a child? And what would you like to tell young people nowadays? And she had this whole list of really interesting questions. And the elderly woman, she started answering the questions and she stopped and she looked at Delia, who was about, at the time, she was probably about 13 or 14. And she said, oh, this is probably really boring to you. And my daughter Delia said to her, No. She said, I'm a foreigner. I mean, she speaks perfect Finnish, so they wouldn't have known that. She said, I'm a foreigner. I don't know anything about your life in Finland when you were a child. She said, it's really interesting. And she said, and I don't have any grandparents here. I live here in Finland without any relatives. She said, so it's really interesting. And the woman cried. She said, nobody ever asks us questions. They tell us it's time to eat, it's time to go to bed, it's time to do this, it's time to do that. She said, nobody ever asks us any questions. And so she sat and talked with Delia for about an hour or so. And it was such to see my daughter using the program, using her kindness and her humility, taking responsibility, being of service, was such a gift, because I could see that what I brought home, my kids were learning. I have another daughter, Moo, we call her. Moo has a real name, but we've never called her anything but Moo. Actually, when she graduated from high school, there was a banner that had all 19 names of the graduates, and it says Laura Moo Rizzo. So, yeah, she's always been Moo. She was one of those kids that you couldn't hug her when she was a child. She's and I'd grab her and I'd hug her and I'd say, "This is good for you," because I knew it was good for her. She wasn't really thrilled. But eventually, now she's the most loving, compassionate. She works with me. I don't work as an architect anymore, by the way. When my children were young and my husband only worked 5 hours a day and we ended up on welfare, I decided I better go to work with my kids. And I didn't believe in putting children in daycare, but guess what? Sometimes you have to. And so what I did was I started an English daycare so I could take my kids to work with me. And I had been a virtues facilitator, teaching children virtues, teaching them about self-esteem for years. It's been like 20 years that I've been doing this. And so I based it on English, but also with this character education. So I could take my kids to work with me, and I could work at the same time and not be on welfare. My daughter works for me now. She works in the school. She is Moo, and she is the most compassionate, sweetest, most loving assistant. She's not a teacher. She doesn't like to read. I told her, like, honey, you're going to have to learn to read. Yeah, she's not real big on reading, but she is going to university now, so I guess she'll have to figure it out. But I don't think they have cliff notes for everything. But, you know, to see my daughter growing up as kind and compassionate as she is, they must have heard something. And Frank, of course, he's just loving and kind and he's brilliant. He's delightful. But I have to go back to so this morning I called home and I said to both of my kids, who were there, Moo and George, I said, okay, what did I teach you? Did I teach you anything as a parent? Okay, Moo's answer. You taught me how to drive, apply makeup, and text message simultaneously. Hi, thanks, Moo. I'm really good at it, though. In Finland, there's not a whole lot of traffic. We learn. I try not to text message anymore while I'm in the car. But I think it's illegal these days. But I asked my son, George, I said, okay, so did I teach you anything? And he said, he said, you told me, you taught me how to not burn bridges. And that was something my father taught me. He said, no matter what, he said, don't burn bridges. And everybody is put in my life for a reason. There isn't anybody that I meet that doesn't teach me something. I have my life path. I have to follow it. You have your life path. They might come together, they might not. But for the time that they are together, even if it's for a 3-minute conversation here at a, you know, World NA convention, you have a message for me, so I need to be quiet and listen. And so there's no reason on earth to burn bridges with people. I just have tried always not to do that. But for some reason, my son was listening once, and so he's learned that. The other thing he said was, Mom, you taught me to be responsible. He said, you can tell me things, and it's my choice what I do. But I'm responsible for the choice, and I'm responsible for the consequences. He got that. And the only reason he got that was because I got it from you. I learned that here. I learned finally what humility was. I learned finally what unconditional love was, to love you. Of course, I didn't love you in the beginning because I didn't love me. Giving birth to 4 children was amazing. It was a miracle. It was the coolest thing I ever did in my life. I was cool then. No drugs. No nothing. I just had those babies. And God help you if you try to take it away from me. It's just like, don't take it to the nursery. It's mine. Mine, mine, mine. The third thing he said that you taught me, Mom, was unconditional love. And he teaches his friends. I didn't tell him, but he was talking to his one buddy. And he's like, dude, you got to be nice to your mom, you know. He said, she's not going to let you go if you're not nice to her. Listen, you got to take responsibility. I'm listening, going, yes, yes, yes. And the cutest thing ever, and I even kind of do it on purpose now, if he's with his buddies, I'll say, hi, George. And he knows that means get over here and give Mom a kiss. And he'll come over, he'll give me a kiss and a hug, and he'll say, hi, Mom, I love you. And his friends are going to be like, kissing your mom. He's like, dude, she's my mom. You don't kiss your mom? What's wrong with you? So it's such a gift for me to watch my children, to watch them grow up into responsible human beings. My one daughter, Delia, I have to say, she kind of goes with her dad, and it broke my heart a little bit. But then I had to remember from here, from in these rooms, I learned I got to love her no matter what. Whether she's here with me or if she spends more time with her father. I mean, she should love her father. That's her father. My kids should love their father. They should spend time with them. But being a parent is the best thing that I was ever. Thank God. I'm so grateful. I have to tell you one last thing. 11:11 every day my alarm goes off on my phone. 11:11, I stop every day and I make my gratitude list in my head. It's still morning, so I can never have a bad day. And my sponsors tell me, make a gratitude list. I didn't like to write. You know, they always told me to write. I said, I don't like to write. But I could make my gratitude list every day. So every day at 11:11, my staff knows it, my kids know it, my friends know it. 11:11, I stop, take a breath, remember everything that I'm grateful for, and then I go on with my day. So it's impossible to ever have a bad day. I only get wonderful days. Today, my alarm went off at 11:11, and I thought, I am so grateful to be here. I'm so grateful to be in San Diego. I wasn't so grateful to be speaking today because I was a little terrified, but I'm so grateful to be in recovery. I'm so grateful to have all of you here and show up. I've been clean 25 years. not only... I'm cool. Thank God, finally I'm cool for something. But I really want to thank all of you for being here. God bless every one of you. Have a wonderful rest of the convention and a wonderful rest of your lives, and I hope we meet sometime again soon. God bless. Thanks.
Wow. Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to thank Daniel and Sean once again for speaking. March G has been asked to come up and read We Do Recover. There she is. Let me get it. There you go. Very much, Mark.
My name is March, and I'm an addict.
Hello, Mark.
We do recover when at the end of the road we find that we can no longer function as a human being, either with or without the drugs. We all face the same dilemma. What is there left to do? There seems to be this alternative, either go on as best as we can to the bitter ends, jails, institutions, or death, or find a new way to live. In years gone by, very few addicts have ever had this last choice. Those who are addicted today are more fortunate. For the first time in man's entire history, a simple way has been proving itself in the lives of many addicts. It is available to us all. This is a simple, spiritual, not religious program known as Narcotics Anonymous.